Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Then What Happened from the Columbus Dispatch. The Cap City is booming with innovative, inspiring, and passionate people with intriguing stories to tell. I'm Amelia Robinson, and I'm here to dive into what makes Columbus and its people fascinating. So, hey, Jen, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, anytime I can get the infamous and famous Jen Miller in here, I'm excited about it. So, yeah. How old is the Ohio League of Women Voters?
We were founded in 1920, so we were formerly the Ohio Woman Suffrage Association. And then as it appeared, hopefully, that the 19th Amendment would be ratified, we transformed to the League. And there were several organizations that came together that are kind of considered the midwives. So kind of the precursor to the Nurses Union and the Teachers Union. There were women who were lawyers, reporters, businesswomen, the Federation of Colored Women's Clubs, the DAR, and the Council on Jewish Women. There were these 14 organizations that came together to form the League. And why? Because we had, as the Women's Suffrage Association, had been working to get women the right to vote for so long, and men were the impediment. Mm-hmm. So
if men are always the impediment.
And so, like, the male voters of Ohio were not, and the male lawmakers were not supportive. Mm-hmm. And so we decided that we needed to learn the logistics and rules of voting and teach other women. So it was really formed by women. And what has happened in that 100 years is that we've really become a champion of all democratic processes and making sure that all voters have access to the ballot, and that if they have barriers, that there are reasonable ways to overcome those barriers, but also a lot on election integrity and election security. So, for example, the fact that you have a poll workers in equal numbers of different parties, that the boards of elections have a director and co-director that are two different parties, all of that, all the runoff rules, the fact that the machines are stored in a room with one Republican key and one Democrat key. We did all that, but we did a whole bunch of other stuff like ADA access and, you know, trying to make sure that ID laws are as inclusive as possible. You know, all of those kinds of things.
I had no idea that was you guys. Thank you. We need that.
Well, you know, like, I think it helps me and my members and my staff because things are hard and policy reform takes a long time. And we have this, like, kind of privilege of looking back for 100 years and realizing that there are things we have achieved that we now take for granted as a state, and that, like, some of the struggles we have today, it's still true, right? That it's going to take a long time. It's really hard, but we will win on behalf of voters.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you just said that, because I was, like, playing around on Facebook, and I should probably not say this, 'cause I don't know if it's true, but a couple people had a meme that said 50 years ago, women couldn't have a credit card and, you know, get a line of credit in their own name, which is, like, mind-blowing, because 50 years ago is, you know, not that long ago. And I say that as someone who is fast approaching 50, right?
Yeah, me too. Yeah, so when we started, that was another piece, is we had a whole advocacy wing that was, you know, when we became the League and when we finally had the right to vote, there were still forced marriages, child marriages, mm-hmm. the inability for women to divorce, the inability for women to get custody. And so when women got the right to vote, they actually sometimes call it the maternalization of the state, because we immediately started advocating for policies that benefited us, but also entire communities. So, you know, kind of the movement for local parks, mm-hmm. You know, public education funding. These are all things that the League of Women Voters and women in general that now had a place in the democratic process, not equitably. Of course.
Right. Well, not equity, but
yeah. Maybe. You know, there were still going to be challenges if you're lower income or you couldn't read or you were of a certain race. Right. Like, these were still challenges, not as much in Ohio as in other parts of the country, mm-hmm. but here too. Right. But the purpose being that the reason why we needed the right to vote was because the government was not really responsive to the needs of women and families and communities. And so the League really was for a long time, the only game in town for representing a lot of these concerns. And it's really been exciting to see so many more advocates in the field. And that allows us to really go back to these nuts and bolts basics about how democracy works.
True crime lovers are always looking for new and engaging content.
The Already Gone podcast covers stories from Michigan and the Great Lakes region. Cases you haven't heard before, like the Mayo Hunters or the murder of 16-year-old Justin Mello. Plus, better-known cases like the death of Jane Bishara and Illinois' own Lori Dann. Already Gone started in 2016, so there is a big back catalog for you to enjoy. Find Already Gone on Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, or your favorite podcatcher.
Well, speaking of democracy, Ohio has been through a roller coaster lately with the whole notion of representation and like what the power of the people and that sort of thing. We had issue one, of course, last August.
Yeah.
And also there's some things coming up with gerrymandering. Where do you think this whole thing is going? Do you feel like we're going backwards? Do you feel like we're going forwards? Or where are we in the whole fight?
Yeah. I mean, so first off, I'll just mention that the league was, formed in 1920. We started studying redistricting in the 1940s to try to understand it. And literally our fight against gerrymandering is older than either you or I, Amelia. And I think it's important just to note that we fought both Republicans and Democrats on this, like in the courts, mm-hmm. in the legislature, in the, commission, where any venue we can. And so what I'll say is this, I think August taught us something that I think maybe a lot of us knew that aren't so strictly in the party system. And that is that Ohio voters really care about democracy. They care about freedom. And they, even if they consider themselves a member of one party or the other, they care about those things more. And they do question, right? I think Ohioans question authority and can think for themselves. So, we are now working on Citizens Not Politicians. We're honored to have been part of the process with Maureen O'Connor developing this language. And now, we have 3,000 or so volunteers with our allies out in the field and more than 72 counties. And we're proud to be a part of all that. But I think ultimately the people of Ohio are going to understand that at the end of the day, politicians and parties only look out for you so much.
Right. And I think you're right. It's Democrats, it's Republicans. It's just about power, right? Maintaining power and getting that power. Well, gerrymandering, right?
Yeah.
Every time I write the word gerrymandering, I go, oh my God, how do I make people understand this concept? Because it's like one of those words that is just, it's a big word. It's a, complicated topic. How do you break that down for people when you talk to them?
So we talk about rigging maps. We talk about this idea that when politicians have the pen and they get to draw new districts, that they're going to do it in a way that benefits them, that they're not thinking about everyday communities, right? They're not thinking about the fact that entire communities should be kept whole, or that, for example, in the last set of map making, that Trotwood should stick with the rest of Dayton. Mm-hmm. They're not thinking about that. What they're looking at house by house by house, how they think the voters will vote, and surgically drawing those maps and splitting and slicing and dicing communities so that they will win their reelection. I've heard people call it cheating. It absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
Rigging maps in one party's or one candidate's favor. It absolutely is. I'm excited, though, because I think more people understand it now.
Right. They do.
Than ever.
Yeah. I think you're totally right. Because a couple years ago, when this whole, gerrymandering started coming up, bubbling up and bubbling up and bubbling up. And we had that vote. I don't think people quite got what the whole thing was. But now you break it down to, hey, fairness. At the end of the day, fairness and also respecting the voter.
Yep.
I think that's one of the reasons that people are so angry about gerrymandering is because it's disrespect. A lot of this is just like, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do to you.
Right. Yeah. And I think most Ohioans consider themselves independent, regardless as to what their primary, past voting record says. Right. I think most people think of themselves independent. And so I think this is where that matters. Right. Is that if one party or the other has outsized control, which we've had in this last process, right, with 5 Republicans, 2 Democrats, which could easily flip the other way. 5 Democrats, 2 Republicans. Mm-hmm. If one party has outsized control, that doesn't serve most of us who consider ourselves independent, right? But additionally, politicians are going to politician.
Oh, politician it up. They're going to politician.
Yeah. And so, I think fundamentally, Ohioans understand that. My dad would was that old school Ohioan that would, whoever was in the presidential seat, he would vote the opposite way for Congress because he believed in a balance of power. And I think we don't always talk enough about that piece, in that this is five Republicans, five Democrats, five independents, and that nothing of significance can pass without two votes from each of those categories. That is truly beyond party, right? It's not even like sticking to this two-party system. It's bringing in independents and people that would probably consider themselves more third party, like Green or Libertarian, into the process.
Do you think these people from these different parties can work together, though? That's the whole thing. I'm like, I often wonder, are we too far gone where we can't sit down and, you know, work things out and like we used to in Ohio, especially?
Well, I mean, let's look at August. That was a movement that was well beyond party, right? We had, you know, labor unions that run the gamut from being quite progressive to fairly conservative, right? We had everyday people. We had churches of all faiths, you know. We had literally the beautiful rainbow of Ohio was represented in that movement to vote no and defeat issue one in August. And I think we can tap into that same thing because there's something very Ohio. And that is that we really actually care about freedom. We don't necessarily trust authority. We certainly don't trust politicians. So I think, like, one, we get it passed that way. But two, remember, these aren't political party players. You know, not only, you know, Citizens Not Politicians bans politicians, but also lobbyists and political party leaders and their spouses or close family members. And so these are going to be everyday people that have, like, maybe they consider themselves Republican, Democrat, or independent, but they don't have the same
buy-in, like, same connection.
Right. Yeah. Because they're not trying to get themselves reelected. They're not trying to get their friends reelected. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we know that it's far easier to draw a map that's fair than rigged. And so, because to rig it, to kind of, like, predetermine party outcomes, to rig it so that you have artificial supermajorities in a state like Ohio that really is more 50-50, takes a lot of work. It takes big data. It takes computers. It takes knowledge about every household, literally, to do that. And so instead, this process says, y'all work together. You have to listen to the people of Ohio in terms of what they consider their communities. And you have to, you know, pass maps that don't favor one party or one candidate.
Yeah. Do you think there's any way around it? Because this last time when we had the vote, what was it, 2018 was the vote?
Yeah.
They found a way around it. And I think people thought it was pretty solid. Like, this is what we want. And they found a way around it. Have you guys kind of mitigated that whole thing to make sure there's no loopholes?
Yeah. So let me say this. Like, we negotiated in that package in 2018, and the League and our allies actually kept walking away from the negotiating table because we were worried it wasn't strong enough. And the biggest sticking point actually was politicians drawing the maps, where the lawmakers that we were negotiating with kept saying that it had to be politicians, and we kept saying we didn't want that. But at the end of the day, we knew we only had so much capacity. And so we knew it wasn't a perfect package, but we also knew that we needed to try to improve things. And it's true that the congressional districts are still gerrymandered, still rigged, but not as bad as last decade. And so we did get something done there, but not enough. But what I'll say is this time we did it differently. Instead of, like, going with what's the best we can get with the capacity we have, we built this massive movement and we brought in the best thinkers and said, what's the policy that will really get it done? And how do we get that passed? And that was because it was no longer just, you know, the League and a couple of our allies, right? It was like, it's this massive tripartisan movement, right? So Republicans, Democrats, independents, experts, you know, from many different communities. It's an Ohio solution. So this was really drafted by Ohioans with, you know, talking to a lot of constitutional scholars and having folks like Maureen O'Connor there. So I feel like we have closed the loopholes. Now, what I'll say to you is this. It's less likely to go to court because when you have everyday people drawing maps and they have to, nothing can get passed without it having, you know, approval from Republicans, Democrats, and independents on this commission, what we're going to see are maps that are pretty good to begin with. But the other piece is if it goes to court, the court has to rule on, they have to look at the record and see what the people of Ohio said. You know, so for example, this Trotwood situation in Dayton, if in the record, which it was this round, people continually asking for Trotwood not to be an African-American neighborhood in Dayton, right? Like, not to be put with very different rural communities, but to be included with Dayton, that they would be listening to that record and they would be telling the mappers to fix that issue. If the mappers don't, they could actually hire their own neutral mappers to fix it. And that's what we didn't have the last time. We had the criteria that the maps could be judged by, which obviously worked because we were one of the litigants, right? Or one of the plaintiffs. And we were able to make the case very easily that these were unfair. So we had the criteria. We had established that the Supreme Court was the primary, or, you know, this should be the sole authority. That got a little funky.
Did it ever?
Yeah. But at the end of the day, the Supreme Court didn't have the ability. It was not, there was no explicit ability to draw their own maps or get their own special mapping masters. We have that now.
Interesting. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that goes and if, you know, what happens in November.
Yeah.
Crazy. November is coming up.
I know.
It's nuts.
And it's been really fun. I'll just tell you, our volunteers are very inspired to do this. They're very excited. People are thrilled to come find us to sign. You know, we do have thousands of volunteers out in the field. And yes, there's also a paid component, but like, this really is the people of Ohio trying to take our democracy back, trying to take our state back, trying to make sure that maps aren't rigged. Because when lawmakers have to fight to win, they have to listen to us. The biggest problem we have right now is like someone gets into office and it doesn't actually matter whether they have an R or D behind their name. They know they're going to win again. So they just play to their big donors. They play to party extremes because they have to win the primary. The general, you know, is what's going to happen in the general is often predetermined because of the way the maps are rigged.
100%.
And so I think this really is taking Ohio back, because if lawmakers, some of them will still be secure, right? Because they're just parts of German Village should probably always be represented by a Democrat. And right. And there's parts of rural Western right. Ohio or Northwestern Ohio that are probably always going to be Republican, because when you keep communities together, there's going to be some districts that stay Republican or stay Democrat, right? But a lot of them are going to swing back and forth. We will see a responsiveness of the state house in a way that we haven't seen before, and Congress. And that means that everyday people have more voice.
Right. They have to listen to you. They respect your vote.
Yeah.
So we talked about the league. We talked about gerrymandering. But what about Jen Miller? So you're actually from a farming community, right?
Yeah. So my family, all my family came from like kind of South Germany to Northwest Ohio. So, and they all lived in Sandusky and Seneca County, and they were all farmers, like, so German farmers there and then German farmers here. And we also had bakers in our family.
Okay.
And so my dad actually got a degree in baking, and he grew up in a bakery and he got a degree in baking. And we bought a bakery before I was born in Shelby, Ohio. So all of my people are from like Clyde, Bellevue, Fremont, right around the Sandusky Bay, right around Cedar Point. The easiest way is to say like 10 minutes from Cedar Point. I grew up in Shelby, just north of Mansfield, because my parents bought a bakery and a diner. And so.
Oh, that's right. I remember you saying you were in Mansfield, because I used to work for the Mansfield.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm a Richland County girl as well. And so, and it was a great childhood. It was complicated because it was like a town that didn't have all the most exciting things going on. And it was I would say, a very homogenous town, which has never really been my biggest, you know, favorite thing. Like, I love cultures and all kinds of people and all those things. But it was great in the sense that I saw my parents regularly as leaders. Mm. You know, it was one of the like only third spaces in my town, right? Lots of churches, a few bars, lots of pizza places where you just ran in and got your pizza and came back out. Mm-hmm. We were only one of two restaurants for most of the time
there. Oh, wow. That's crazy.
And so I saw my parents like talk about issues, but never candidates or parties. And I saw them like also be employers and have to balance the books and do marketing. And it was in that way, it was a really good childhood, because I felt like I started kind of working at like 4, where I would fill up the salt and pepper shakers, which I probably made a big mess, and they were just trying to keep me out of their hair so we could close up, you know.
But don't play with the salt. Right?
Yeah, right. But, you know, I mean, I was running the cash register by the time I was 8, I was, I had two nicknames. One was Sunshine and the other was The Boss. And it was a good childhood. And I think, weirdly enough, it really set me up for what I do now.
Yeah, because you have a personality that's like, you know, demanding. Like, you know, you're not a shrinking violet. Yeah. So you're the youngest too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You think that kind of helped being like the youngest, the one that was like the parents probably were maybe a little bit stricter on the older ones?
But... Yeah, I mean, I think so. But I will say this, like, sadly, I had a brother pass away when I was a kid. And so My parents were also... They were super protective, but not necessarily strict. Those are a little bit different, you know? So there's a lot of things my friends could do that I wasn't allowed to do. But
like what?
You know, like I couldn't spend the night places for a long time. And, you know, he died in a car accident. So my town didn't have a Taco Bell. And so all my friends in high school.
Small town, man.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it does now, but it didn't then. And so one of the things we would do would be like pile into someone's car to drive to Mansfield to go to Taco Bell.
That's hilarious. Right.
And yeah. And so, you know, the cultural center of Taco Bell, you know, but like I wasn't allowed to do that stuff. I would have to sneak around to do that stuff. But on the other hand, we were a very tight family. You know, I think like when you lose a child, you are centered on what's most important, you know, so like. It didn't matter how mad we were at each other. We made sure we told each other that we loved each other kind of thing. You
was
know?
Was he a little boy when he died or was he a teenager?
He was a little boy. So he was 8 and I was 4.
Oh, wow. That's awful.
Yep. Yep. And I think that like centered me into just wanting to always make the world a better place. You know, I'd just kind of had this sensitivity to suffering and I always wanted to find my space for that. And I first like really saw it. As silly as it sounds, I really saw it at the bakery, right? Mm. Like, because like someone would pass away and what would they do? They would come in and get like dozens of donuts to take to that family. You know, like I actually first saw it that way. And then I just found a different way to kind of do that.
What's your brother's name?
His name was Matthew.
Matthew.
Matthew James.
Oh, yep. That's a great name.
Yeah.
So what was your favorite like county fairs? Because one thing I love that area, I covered a lot of fairs when I was at the Mansfield News Journal.
Yeah.
Which one was your favorite one?
Well, of course, we went to Richland, but we also would go to the county fair in Fremont as well sometimes with like my family, because all of my extended family was still in Clyde and Bellevue and Fremont. So I loved all the fairs, right? Like I just loved all the animals and
the Bratwurst Festival and all that.
Oh yeah, totally went to the Bratwurst Festival every year. And we had a 4th of July event called Bicycle Days that I used to go to in Shelby. And that was fun. I liked all of them. But the big thing was that we went to Cedar Point all the time.
Mm.
I say I was raised Lutheran and also on a roller coaster, you know, like.
So it's like funny, too. When I first moved down the Dayton area, people always talked about Kings Island. I'm like, that's not even a roller coaster park.
Right.
What are you talking about? Right. Like, go to Cedar Point, fools.
Yeah, I know.
Why even bother?
I do like Kings Island, but it does not compare to Cedar Point. It's true.
It does not. So how'd you kind of transition into the whole league work?
Yeah. So I actually I came here to go to Capitol and I have degrees in vocal music and history and ethnic studies.
So we'll go ahead and have you sing a little bit.
And I first went into the arts and I was like, and I loved it. I worked for Rec and Parks. I worked for Music in the Air, you know, when Music in the Air produced Festival Latino and Shortener Sunday Jazz and all these other and really just kind of I loved presenting free concerts to the community that of various kind of cultural performances that represented the community. I loved that. Then I actually went to the King Arts Complex and I did in the height of their programming. I did a lot of that programming and I did a lot of interdisciplinary stuff. So like looking at slavery, for example, where maybe we would have we would talk about. You know, Harriet Tubman, a show about Harriet Tubman for the kids, but then also have, you know, an exhibit on, you know, the chocolate trade and the sugar trade, you know, like just always trying to combine and really look at, use the arts to look at issues. Did that with domestic violence and AIDS epidemic, all these different things. And went to grad school. And when I got out of grad school in 2008, it was during the recession and the arts were not being as entrepreneurial as I wanted to be. I wanted to continue to do these interdisciplinary explorations of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And not like tell people what to think, but like literally open spaces for dialogue.
Examination of it.
Yeah. And so a lot of arts organizations had smaller budgets and they didn't want to take that kind of risk. And so I actually went into environmental work and I went and worked at the Sierra Club for 10 years doing environmental issues. And
that
I would
super interesting.
I would say that is also like my childhood. We spent every weekend like camping and fishing and boating. And so I loved kind of our public lands. I loved clean water. So I worked on those issues. And what was happening was I was noticing at the State House, this was like after, you know, the energy efficiency and renewable energy standards were passed and then gutted, right, that I could go into the State House and I could use actually the utility company's own words about how these clean energy programs were saving customers money and reducing pollution. That these were the words in their filings at the Public Utilities Commission. But then they would cross the street to the State House and say the exact opposite. And they were getting away with it.
Hmm.
And I was like, this is a democracy issue, right? When I have to work so hard for just kind of lead abatement programs for to protect kids. And if I have to work so hard for like protecting Lake Erie from, you know, the toxic algae blooms, you know, we were talking about how at some point Toledo wasn't going to have clean water and they all looked at us like we were crazy. And then it happened, mm-hmm. right? And I realized it was a democracy issue. And so I decided to go to the league and work on that. And I've always been someone that wants to work on social change and politics, but I've never been a party person. And I think it's again, goes back to like the way my parents were community leaders. And so in that way, like League has been like a homecoming for me, because it's hard for people to imagine folks being in politics that really are just focused on the policies, right? And really being disciplined about leaving their own biases at the door in terms of who they want as a candidate or what party they affiliate with and just work on the function of democracy itself. But that's what this organization does. So it's hard work, but I kind of feel like I won the lottery because I get to like work with voters across Ohio and with these amazing advocates who've been doing this for decades.
So like obviously the league in the last couple of years has been, you know, kind of attacked and everything like that. How do you think people feel about the league? Do people see the league for what, how you see it, or how do you see it?
Yeah, this is funny because I, on a regular, like when I'm out in the world, like at the gym or something, and people don't know me and they'll ask what I do, they're always excited about it. The general public is excited about it. We are still a brand that is trusted. You know, I think that you have to get into the kind of inner circle, right, of the State House or DC or whatever, to really have different thoughts than that. But we get attacked because we're threatening.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if we weren't effective and really helping voters understand how democracy is working and not working, if we were not effective in empowering voters to make their own decisions and overcome whatever barrier they have to the ballot box, if we weren't effective, we wouldn't be attacked. And so I look at it like this, you know, yeah, it's hard, but this is what happens when you take on power, you know, and what we have in Ohio is a lot of corrupt folks running our state, and they're not thinking about the various communities of the state. They're not thinking about what is best for the children of the state for decades to come. They're not necessarily even thinking about what's best for businesses or the economy. And or water, whatever it is. And so the work we do must be impactful because they would ignore us otherwise.
Truth. That is the truest statement I've ever heard, because literally sometimes when people, you know, come at me, I'm like, well, thank you. I appreciate your comments.
Well, and you know what else is funny, and people don't realize this, but in some circles, we are considered way too conservative. Right. In other circles, we're way too liberal. And it's literally just like all of my friends who are political reporters, right? That, you know, you all get like, depending on what the story looks like, you get attacked for being one or the other.
And sometimes the same story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Often the same story, often the same decision that League makes. We're getting flack from both sides, you know? And ultimately, at the end of the day, democracy should be about dialogue. And so I'll take that feedback. And I'll think about it, you know, but at the end of the day, we know what we're sending. Like, voters are our North Star always. And we will work together to figure out what we think is the best path to advocate for voters.
Can I say, are you hopeful for Ohio, or how you feeling overall?
I am hopeful for Ohio. And I think like the reason why I get to be hopeful is because, yeah, okay, I spend a lot of time in kind of the sausage making, right? The policy discussions. But I also, again, this goes back to like feeling like I win the lottery. It's like I get to travel the state talking to everyday voters about how they feel about democracy and what they want their state to be. And I have faith in the people of Ohio. I really do. I've often believed that if it didn't matter what subject matter it was, if we could get everyone in the same room and debate like just a group of everyday Ohioans from different perspectives, that we would come up with policy solutions that are common sense. And I think that's true for democracy. And so I am very excited about Citizens Not Politicians. I know we'll get on the ballot, and I know it's going to be really, really hard campaign to win, but I know we're going to win. And then I think that will be the beginning of really taking our state back for the people.
The power to the people. Thanks a lot for coming in and talking to me. This was awesome. I really enjoy hearing your story and learning more about you.
Thank you. It was so fun.
Yeah.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.